Each year, the Library of Congress selects 25 films to be preserved and added to the National Film Registry, typically a mix of classic films and important early titles. In recent years, the library has shown some preference for the inclusion of avant-garde and experimental works. Case in point, the recent selection of Bill Morrison's extraordinary film, Dickasia. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. Dickasia was made in 2002 and is a fantasia of sound and mesmerizing vision, brilliantly assembled from decaying film stock by a cinema artist of the first order. Bill Morrison wrote, directed, edited, and produced Dickasia, and this important film has the added distinction of being the most modern film ever selected for the National Film Registry. I'm delighted to have Bill Morrison on the program today. Good morning, sir.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for reaching out to us by telephone. I know you're on the road from Florida, but you generally make New York your home base. Belated congratulations on the selection of Dickasia in mid-December to the National Film Registry. That's quite an honor, I know.
Oh, thank you.
Now, the National Film Registry, for those who don't know, is overseen by the Library of Congress and typically selects films of much greater vintage. Yours is the most contemporary film. But it is made up of bits and pieces of much older film. I'm thinking when we often use the term experimental film, it's a term we use because to try to describe films that are profoundly adventurous but don't fit the simple categories of commercial cinema. When you present this film to audiences that maybe haven't not seen it, how do you try to contextualize it and describe what it is?
I sometimes have gotten questions when I've shown it from audiences who just watched it. They were like, what was that? and I sometimes try to describe it as a meditation or even an enforced meditation because it's a film that invites your mind to wander even while you're watching it. There isn't a narrative. It's not telling you exactly where to go. And in fact, at times you're staring at, like for instance, an image of camels crossing the screen from left to right. And, of course, you know that they're going to get to the other side of the screen. So what's interesting is what's happening to the film and really to your retina while you're watching that camel. You're in some sort of state of between engaging with the image and realizing that that image is recorded on a plastic medium, on film, and that it's aged and that all those the people and animals represented on the film are no longer with us, and so your mind is invited to wander and embrace other thoughts that might come to you as you watch it.
I love your use of the term plastic because it not only refers to the film material itself, but the imagery we're watching moves and is plastic itself in its not only composition, but how it interacts with each of these pieces of film that's in various states of decomposition that you've selected and edited together a number of pieces of film that are literally decomposing.
Yeah, that's it. I think when we started the project, we were really struck by a couple shots that we found in an archive, one of a boxer who was, I guess at one point, boxing a punching bag, and that punching bag had become an amorphic blob because the film itself had deteriorated right there. So it quite literally looked like he was fighting decay or chaos, and that sort of became the metaphor for the film. I tried to find things that more or less supported that, and the idea that, of course, we are all spirits within a body, something that is given to deteriorate over time. And that film in some ways could be a metaphor for our own experiences.
And impermanence.
All these films.
Right.
Impermanence and also just housing memories. You know, all these films that sat on archive shelves and were forgotten were somebody's life's work at some point. And so they are quite literally visual memories or dreams even that are housed in some sort of vehicle that is rusting and decaying, and so it seemed like a very poignant metaphor for me.
You definitely have that sense of temporal shift that something is being communicated from a forgotten past to the viewer, but then being mixed with the current state of that particular piece of film. I think in the first few minutes of the film, what's fascinating to me is how it engages just how our brains work. Your initial reaction, I think, is to try to resolve what the underlying image is, despite the fact that there's so much foreground decomposition. Our brain is still trying to assign values and meaning to what's underneath the original image that is now mostly obscured. And then this amazing thing happens where we just kind of let go, and the foreground decomposition and the background imagery merge into this new thing that's synthesized and engages us in new ways.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. It seems like we're almost, if there are a set of eyes to be seen on screen, we're seeking those out at all times and sort of zeroing in on those. Or at one point, an airplane emerges and reemerges and disappears between spots of decay, and we're always trying to find where that airplane is going to show up again. And I do think that there is these parts of our brain are constantly seeking something that we recognize that we can hold on to, whereas at the same time we're kind of receiving messages from this almost random chaotic decay that's working on our brain in a completely different way. So, I think when it's successful, you release into that, and if not, you leave the theater, maybe.
No, I don't think so. My 16-year-old son, I hit him unawares of this, and he was instantly entranced by it.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so I think that even people who don't have a background, I think a lot of experimental films require you to bring some knowledge to the experience to appreciate the film, but in your case, I really believe this is an experimental film that in some ways is self-evident in its beauty and impact, and that really is accessible to the viewer despite their background.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that that it speaks to a wider audience and not just the avant-garde film world, because that could be somewhat self-contained.
The decomposition of each piece you didn't have control over, but you had absolute control over your selection and how those went together and fit together and the speed at which you projected them. I'm wondering just how much footage you went through to compile this particular set of images.
I think it was something like 100 hours of footage. I mean, it's hard to say, because in some cases I was able to whiz through VHS tapes to see what was on an entire tape and then go back to those films that were represented on that tape to call up those reels. So, and in some cases you're looking at film at the exact speed that, if you're at a library and you're looking at a reference film print, you can't speed through it. So it gets hard to gauge really how many hours.
And we should mention this is a 67-minute or just over a one-hour film that you've ended up with.
And really looking for those images that were, again, most beautifully affected by the decay, because there's decay and then there's decay. This is when it's most interesting. It's the type of decay that happens to nitrocellulose film, the old film stock from before 1950, which is made up of basically the same ingredients as gunpowder, explosives, and much of our film heritage has been lost. Some people estimate 90% of our pre-1950 film heritage has been lost due to warehouse fires because this stuff is so flammable. But it also has a slower oxidation process where it melts and eventually melds together and becomes a solid disc before turning into powder. And if you can get it somewhere before that, interesting things can happen with the way the emulsion interacts with the base, so that it actually seems as if the decay is seeking out the film, finding perhaps areas within the features of a face or around it, creating auras that are specific to the image rather than just being a patina obliterating the image. It's actually working with the image. So that's a more rare find, and it was something we were looking for. And then, of course, how does that support this idea that decay is an underlying fact of life that we have to deal with, that it's either something we're fighting or that we're trying to transcend, or it can be ironic, it can be tragic, it can be humorous. The fact is that it's the state of all things. And so we would look again for of those things that had beautifully decayed, what imagery supported that. And then within that, we'd start finding images that rhymed with each other that came roughly from the same category. For instance, I started finding arcades or pillars that were separated by equal increments, and that became a visual metaphor for time and the past, and film, of course, is separated by equal increments. We also started to find imagery of cruelty to women, which became its own subcategory that occurs throughout the film and was completely unexpected. But as we started collecting imagery, this became an evident theme that it was incorporated into the film.
You know, there's not a narrative per se, but your selection of these images and how they are relate to one another and the sequence therein, I think the viewer still begins to read some kind of storytelling into this, that there's certainly, when you combine the amazing music by Michael Gordon that you collaborated with, the composer Michael Gordon, one brings to it a certain dramatic arc, or there's crescendos, there's organizing principles that you've, I guess, left loose enough that the viewer can still read in a multitude of interpretations, yet there's still something there. There's a sense that there's still this secret narrative that if you could just decode it, you could figure it all out.
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you're putting something together like this, it'd probably be more difficult if there were random than if there were not.
Right.
Yeah, I had organizing principles, things that sometimes I grouped decay just by how it visually rhymed mm-hmm. with itself. You know, different types of decay, where there's a great theme of cycles throughout
yes.
it. You know, whether they're the wheels of a film lab, or a spinning Sufi dancer, or women working at a loom. There's this idea that things decay, they fall apart, but they can be also reprised into something new. Is quite literally what the film is. It's a new film made out of the disintegrated bits of other films. So circularity became a theme, and that implied linearity also, where decay is an end, where there is no chance of reprisal.
You know, we often think of decay as a negative, and this is not a film about destruction or loss. It's rather about transfiguration into something maybe equally as beautiful as the original, and in some cases maybe more compelling from an artistic sense. I'm not sure if I had just seen the fragments of film restored without the decomposition that they would have been all that significant of moving images for me.
Right.
Yet now they are something truly extraordinary.
I think also, I mean, now that celluloid is really becoming part and parcel with the 20th century,
yes,
it brings up the question is, how will the images that we shoot today be stored, and what will they look like in 100 years?
Do you find people coming to your film looking for some sort of polemic about editorializing about the loss of our film medium and the move to all digital?
I can't help but feel like that was part of its selection to the National Film Registry. Was
mm-hmm.
I feel like we're in dialogue with that in a way that we didn't even really intend to be back in 2000 when we were making the film, you know?
Right.
But of course, it certainly came up when we released it on Blu-ray. It was sort of, well, here,
right.
We've come full circle here, you know?
Well, you know, we think of all the all-digital present and future, and you know, if anybody in preservation knows, when digital goes bad and becomes corrupted, it's just gone.
There's no beautiful shades of gray, right?
It's right.
Either it's a one or a zero.
There or not, and
yeah.
Non-existence, whereas the film, as you've shown in Decasia, can really has this in-between step of this becoming this new organism, sort of a chrysalis giving birth to something just fascinating. And the film begins and ends with what I gather is a Sufi whirling dervish type dancer spinning in circles. And it's not only suggestive, I guess, of the movement of the film and time and the real, but you know, sort of the unstoppable nature of time. But you know, that dervish, that's part, that comes out of a spiritual tradition, a sort of liturgical expression that's used in religious ceremonies. And I certainly sensed, you know, your film engaging at a much deeper non-intellectual level and producing this incredible meditative trance state. Was that one of the organizing principles that you were trying to achieve with it?
I think of it as of course, it's framed by this Sufi dancer, and then he appears again in the middle of the film, mm-hmm. Sort of between this, what I think of a movement about circularity and a movement about linearity. And for me, he's the feed reel and the take-up reel on the project. You know, it's his dream.
The leader and tail, right?
Yeah. And then there's many dreams within that. It's sort of structured like an onion, where you then have the dream of the Tokyo siren walking by the screen, and with sort of this kimono that becomes, has the same design as the decay that starts to emanate from it. And she reappears at the end as well. And so it's sort of framed within these dreams within dreams, I would like to think of it as, anyway.
And if we think of it without maybe a specific narrative, it does have an arc, like a story. It has an ending, and that final reel, as the images begin to portray people turning their backs, walking off, setting suns, get the sense of finality, of coming to an end. You know, so again, I think people can find in it arcs that they can relate back to and reference to, you know, maybe whatever film tradition they come out of, or the types of films they're thinking of, even though this is a completely new type of film for them. I'm just curious that when you're working with something this plastic or this flexible, as far as constructing a film like Dickasia, at what point did you feel, okay, this is it, this is the edit, everything is locked in now, it's exactly what I envisioned? Or do you ever get to that point with a film like this?
Well, I'm past the point where I say I should have done this and I should have done that.
Right.
But I do, to back up, this was a film that features Michael Gordon's incredible symphony, which has really made waves in the music world to the same degree that this has in the film world. It's an incredible piece of music, and I was very fortunate to be hooked up with him. And the way the film came about was Michael had received a commission to write a new symphony, and he asked me and my collaborators at Ridge Theater to create a visual counterpoint to that would be projected during performance. So we had always imagined there being an edit that, you know, would not be synced perfectly at the premiere, that it would, first of all, we were cutting on 35 millimeter and then making what we call a reduction print, shrinking it down to 16 millimeter for the premiere. We had three different identical prints, but running on three different 16 millimeter projectors, all running at wildly different speeds. So that there wasn't any chance that we were going to be hitting, and I was cutting to a MIDI draft that Michael had made, and now we were going to be performing with a orchestra for the first time, a conductor we hadn't met. So we just wanted to make sure there was enough film to cover the whole symphony when we premiered it. So then we made a recording of those rehearsals and performance and edited that together, and now we had the soundtrack that we hear today. And I cut that for Sundance, which was a few months later, in January, went to Sundance and said, wow, I should have hit that beat, or I should switch those two shots because it should be coming out of this and going into that. And pretty soon I had a dozen or so changes I wanted to make. And I went back to the edit, and this again was cut on film. It wasn't cut digitally. So we had to reconform negative to make a new print for its premiere in New York, which was at MoMA in May. So at that point, I was pretty convinced that I had the film that I wanted. Now, to be honest, I'm sort of making the same film over and over again. I'm always interested in this dynamic between decaying celluloid and what it says about us and our spirituality and our life on this earth. And so wherever I can include decay, I do. Wherever it's appropriate, or whether there's something I found that just has to be honored. I have, of course, a new a documentary film out now, The Great Flood, which talks about the 1927 Mississippi River flood. That's in distribution through Icarus Films now, and many of those scenes are decayed. And, of course, the decay means something different, but it's still about the human journey, and this decay is, again, humidity affecting film, so it's about water and how we interact with water.
And one of the interesting postscripts, I think, to the story of at least Dickasia is that Hurricane Sandy destroyed your own prints of the film.
That was interesting. that was quite a struggle. Hurricane Sandy filled up my basement and 2 feet of the ground floor of where we live in the East Village of New York City. Yeah, it took care of some prints that had been around the block, let's say. So maybe it was time to replace them anyway. We did get a couple pristine black and white prints out of Alpha Cine Lab in Seattle before they shuttered their doors only a few months ago. So we felt like we got under the wire where we could actually still make a black and white print that had a 5:1 track. I don't think there is any lab left that does that now.
Well, I'm glad your film is now being preserved and maintained for the ages, so I would encourage all of our listeners to check this out. And Bill Morrison, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you about your film, Dickasia.
Oh, thanks for such a great chat. You know, it's wonderful to talk to someone who appreciates film and is knowledgeable about it and understands what my film's about, so I really, really appreciated this opportunity.
Fantastic. My guest has been artist and filmmaker Bill Morrison. His extraordinary 2002 experimental film, Dickasia, was recently selected for inclusion in the Library of Congress's National Film Registry. Morrison wrote, directed, edited, and produced the film, and Dickasia is available on DVD and Blu-ray through Icarus Films, along with several of Morrison's other films. For more about Bill Morrison and his work, and to see some clips from Dickasia, log on to BillMorrisonFilm.com. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. Thanks to Dennis Wu for engineering today's show. I'm Charles Horak. Thanks for listening to On Film.